Okay, it's about time for us to begin our study tonight. When this auditorium class has undergone a number of changes over the years, and one time when Fred was going to take this class, what he decided to do was, you know, you couldn't get people to move up. So what he did was just move everybody back. He got them together. So now here we are. You're back here. And I want to show some slides. And I'm going to have my back to them. And I don't see them out here. I don't have a monitor. I've got this right here. We're going to try this. And Tracy's going to do my advancing of the slides and everything. And I'm going to try to... I want to show you a few things, just sort of summarizing some things about our study. So first, I want to begin with a map and want to show you, remember that this is the Aegean and there's the island of Patmos. So everyone can see the island of Patmos there, the southern Aegean Sea. Okay, let's go to the next one. All right, now this is a map of the island itself, just so you can see it. It wasn't a huge island, but it wasn't just a little dab. You can see there it has roads that can be traveled and everything. So, but that's the island of Patmos, okay? And then there's just the picture. There are a lot of pictures available on the island showing the bay and some of the hills and mountains and so on, okay? All right. Now, as we are studying the seven churches, the letters to the seven churches, what we're seeing is this glorified Jesus, the glorified Christ that we see in chapter 1. The glorified Christ is addressing a message to each one of the seven churches. And the primary message of the letters is to overcome every problem. Overcoming is a thing that's really big and is really emphasized in these letters. And when I have preached on overcoming, I have some lessons I've done on that. And one of the points I've made is that the trials of life are not for the purpose of getting us down. The purpose of the trials of life is to furnish us with the opportunities to grow by overcoming. So every one of the problems, everything that is mentioned in these seven letters was to be overcome. And one of the points we made was that before a church can meet and deal with its external foes, it has to deal with its internal foes. And I believe that is the reason why here we have chapters 2 and 3 dealing with these letters right here at the beginning of the book. So it's really a very logical, a very beautiful arrangement with chapter 1 showing us the introduction to the vision and the glorified Christ. And then chapters 2 and 3 showing the churches as they are instructed to deal with the problems that they have and so on. Okay, now these letters were written to specific congregations. And in that thing that Greg Gwynn, the points that he had done, that was one of the points he emphasized. And we've emphasized that too. These were written to specific congregations. But the problems they faced and how they responded to those problems form a spectrum of congregations throughout the world and throughout the ages, for that matter. And so the letters would fit congregations of today just as easily. And so that's the reason why. And we made the point during the time we were just looking at these seven letters a little earlier that he could have chosen seven other churches, probably seven other churches. But he chose seven that would cover a whole spectrum of conditions and dealt with those things. Now, I think that before I go any further on that, we'll just let that hang there for just a moment. There are a few things that I want to go back and look at, because one of my goals in this series is to show you how much John and the Holy Spirit relies upon the Old Testament prophets. One thing I want you to become aware of in the study of Revelation is how much John taps into the Old Testament prophetic literature for his symbols and everything. We've already done that some, but there are a few things that I want to call your attention to in that description of Jesus, the glorified Jesus there in chapter 1. So if you'll have your Bibles there in chapter 1, verse 14, where it is describing Jesus. His head and his hair were white as white wool, white as snow, and his eyes were as a flame of fire, and his feet like unto burnished brass, as if it had been refined in a furnace, and his voice as the voice of many waters. All right, now, at that point, let's go back to Daniel. Go back to Daniel 7, and we're not going to spend much time on this. It won't take much time to do this. I just want us to read and look at the similarity. So in Daniel 7 and verse 9. Now we'll just give the setting. Basically, this is a parallel vision. In Daniel 7, this is parallel vision to Daniel 2. And that you see a sequence of empires being shown here. And now in verse 9, Daniel says, I beheld till thrones were placed, and one that was ancient of days did sit. His raiment was white as snow. Now right here is where I want you to really begin tightening the screws in your mind. Really concentrate and look at these things. See? His raiment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. You see any similarities there between that and this one that's described in chapter 1 of Revelation? Do you see that? The hair like wool being the idea of white. And now then look over in chapter, let's see, wait just a minute. All right, look over in chapter 10. Over in chapter 10 and verse 6. Now let's see who this is while we're here in chapter 10. Daniel was talking about himself and the preparation he had made. He was fasting and all of this. And so in verse 4 he says, And in the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, which is Hiddekel, I lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with pure gold of Uphaz. His body also was like a jewel called the beryl, or some say the topaz. And his face was as the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as flaming torches, and his arms and his feet like unto burnished brass. Now, did everybody see in that verse also the very notable similarities between the personage being described here and the glorified Jesus being described in chapter 1? These couldn't be an accident. In other words, the fact that John's language over in Revelation 1, as he describes Jesus, the fact that it is so similar, almost the very same words are used, that cannot be an accident. So what is John saying, and more importantly, what is the Holy Spirit saying by using language of Jesus in Revelation 1, that is used of God, clearly God, in Daniel 7 and verse 9, and certainly a heavenly being of some sort here in Daniel 10. So what's he saying? That's right. He is showing a commonality between God in the Old Testament and Jesus here in the New. No. So here the glorified Jesus. I really want you to see that, though. This is not imagination. It is for real. These terms describing the glorified Christ there in Revelation 1 are taken from these passages in Daniel 7, 9 and Daniel 10, 4 or 6, I believe it was. Daniel 10, verse 6. So the Spirit is making a point, and really it is the Spirit. And I think it's important to emphasize the Spirit here, because it was the same Spirit that revealed it to Daniel. And here's that Spirit revealing it to John. And he's doing it in such a way as to say, This is the same one. All right, there's another thing I want to show you now. Look back over in Revelation 1. And we're going to go back to another prophet here. In verse 16 of Revelation 1, he had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth proceeded a sharp two-edged sword. Out of his mouth proceeded a sharp two-edged sword. Okay, let's go back to Isaiah now. Go back to Isaiah. And I'm not going to just go into too many passages, like we could spend the rest of the time talking tonight about that psalm that I've told you about so often and the figures and images that are in it that are also related to this, like the rod of iron. Okay, so look here in Isaiah 48. Look in verse 2. Now this passage begins, "Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye peoples, from far. The Lord has called me from the womb. From the bowels of my mother hath he made mention of my name, and he hath made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand hath he hid me, and he hath made me a polished shaft. In his quiver hath he kept me close, and he said unto me, You are my servant, Israel, in whom I will be glorified. But I said, I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing in vanity. Yet surely the justice due to me is with the Lord, and my recompense is with my God. And now saith the Lord, that formed me from the womb to be a servant, to bring Jacob unto him." Now as he goes on here in verse 6, he says, "It is too light a thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles." Now this verse is quoted in Acts 13 and verse 47 by the Apostle Paul in his sermon at Antioch of Pisidia. And he quotes this verse out of these verses, out of this context, and applies them to Jesus. So it is Jesus, prophetically, who is speaking here. "And he has made my mouth like a what? A sharp sword." Now, I hope you can see that when John, therefore, describes this being over in chapter 1 of Revelation, standing here in all of his glory, and out of his mouth is proceeding a sharp sword. Anyone need any more help than that, seeing the connection? You know, I mean, isn't that clear? "He hath made my mouth sharp sword." The Spirit knew about that. He inspired Isaiah. And so now he's inspiring John, and he's making this connection. And I tell you again, to me, these connections between prophecies that were made many hundreds of years before and the revelation that John was receiving, those things could not be done by men. And so that's one thing that's really, really interesting to me about this book of Revelation. The language that is used in it, therefore, is to a great extent established, the meaning of the language that's used in Revelation is to a great extent established by the meaning it has in the prophets of old. Okay? Now that's a principle that I really want you to work on and really grasp that. So that instead of it being an arbitrary thing, we just go in and make it say whatever we want it to say. We make it mean whatever we want it to mean. No, the meaning of the language in Revelation is established in the language of the prophets. And the symbols and everything that he uses are done like that. So I wanted to mention those connections between the description of the glorified Jesus here and those Old Testament prophets, that language of the prophets, before we go any further. All right, let me go back now to the slides, and I wanted to look at the pattern of the letters. The pattern varies a little bit, but these parts are pretty well there in all of them. You'll have a little bit of variation in the order, but you've pretty well got all of these things. So in the pattern of the letters, first you have the salutation. The salutation would be to the angel of the church in Ephesus. See, that's to whom it is addressed. Second, you have a part of the description of the glorified Christ. Now, in every letter, there will be some part of that picture of Jesus recorded in chapter 1. He will use that to describe himself. So, you see, he won't use the whole thing in every letter, each letter, but he will use parts of it. And as he does that, he is identifying himself as the one who stands where? In the midst of the lampstands, in the midst of the churches, holding the seven stars in his, and here I am holding my left hand, holding the seven stars in his right hand, and so on. All right, so you have the salutation, then you have part of the description of the glorified Christ, like here in Ephesians or in the letter to the church at Ephesus. These things saith he that holdeth the seven stars in his right hand, he that walketh in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. So you see how he is describing himself there? Okay, and then number three, commendation for the good things, if there are good things. If the judge, who is Jesus, sees good things, then he commends them for that. And so most of them have some things, but one or two of them don't have any good things. And then number four is condemnation of the bad things. Here's the objection Jesus has. And there are two of the church he doesn't have any condemnation of. But in most of them, there is a condemnation of something bad. If the judge sees something bad, he tells them about it. And then number five, a warning. There is a warning that he gives. And then number six, exhortations, as he calls upon them to do something, to do whatever will correct the matter. Or if it's not something to be corrected, an encouragement for them to remain faithful and so on. And then promises. And every one of them has some kind of a promise, like at the close of the letter to the church at Ephesus, to him that overcometh, to him will I give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. So you see what we mean? Now this is a part. This is a part of the pattern. Now we've been studying the letter to the church at Ephesus, and we're pretty well through with that, but I just want to go back over it real quick and show you how it fits now. Okay, yes. Yes, yes. And whether you call that an exhortation, you know, he that hath ears to hear, let him hear, or whether you're, that's fine. That's exactly right. That's a part of it too. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. All right. In fact, we're going to say, Buford, did you happen to look up any of the prophetic language of the Old Testament on that one when you went over it? You know, in Isaiah. Okay. All right. I want to give a little attention to that in a minute, but yes, that's definitely a part of the exhortation. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches. All right. Now, just quickly going over the letter to the angel of the church at Ephesus. The self-designation, the one who holds the stars, the one who walks in the midst of the lampstands. This is the one who is in control. This is the one who can remove a lampstand if a church becomes unfaithful. So that's the self-designation. And then the commendation. He compliments the church. I know your works, your toil, your patience or perseverance. You cannot bear evil men. You have not put up with evil men and tested the claims of them who said they were apostles and were not. He says, you have not grown weary. Now, you need to distinguish between growing weary. Growing weary, they had not grown weary in that they had not stopped doing those things. So there's no contradiction between the idea they left their or lost their first love, they left their first love, and they haven't grown weary. They haven't grown weary means that of these things he commends them for, they haven't quit doing that. They have gone on doing that. But what he's getting at is their feeling of fervor and zeal. That's what he's getting at in a moment when he talks to them. You have not grown weary. He commends them because they hate the works of the Nicolaitans. You hate the work of the Nicolaitans as I do. Now, the Nicolaitans are mentioned again in chapter 2 and verse 15 in the letter to the church at Pergamum. So you have some that hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans in like manner. Now, as we look at that, just a moment, I think that's where I remember we kind of got through the last time. I didn't say much more about that. So let me just point you to that passage there in chapter 2 once again, in verse 14 and verse 15. But I have a few things against thee, because thou hast there some that hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit fornication. So hast thou also some that hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans in like manner. So that's the really the only identification we have of what these Nicolaitans were and what they taught. But it was some kind of a permissive kind of a teaching that minimized immorality and so on. And I think I had mentioned to you last time, didn't I? Do you remember my saying anything to you about the doctrine of Gnosticism? I believe that was almost the last thing we mentioned in class last time. If this letter were written toward the end of the first century, as I think it was, by that time, Gnosticism had begun to come. And I want to tell you that I know that a lot of people, like several of you, might be out here and you might be thinking, Gnosticism, I don't know what that is. I never heard of that. Well, there might be a lot of other things you haven't heard of, but you have to hear of it the first time or you'll never learn about it, will you? And so when you hear about something that you don't know, then what you want to do is just simply find out, well, what is that? And once you find out what it is, it's not hard. So don't ever feel kind of intimidated when you run into something and you say, I don't know much about that. Really, it's pretty simple. So let me just explain just very briefly here about this Gnosticism. I'm not going to go into it much. We'll save that for a little later. But Gnosticism was a doctrine that arose that was connected with a very old and a very common idea in that day, which was that once anything took physical form, it was corrupted or defiled. So you say, now, how could that be? Well, think about this. You have in your mind the pattern and the idea of the most beautiful piece of furniture that there ever was. And as long as that stays in your mind, it is flawless. But when you begin to put that into wood, would there be any piece of wood furniture that you could not find a flaw with somewhere, some tiny little spot, something? So that, and say, used to be when women sewed, they'd have a pattern in mind. Here was this beautiful outfit they were going to sew, and as long as that outfit was in their mind or maybe on in a picture there, it was just perfect. Begin to try to execute that thing, put it into reality in the sense of making it take physical form, and the imperfections, they come in there. So a lot of people had the idea that the real thing and perfection was only in the field of ideas. Can you kind of see how that would be? Because haven't you ever had that experience? You had the most wonderful plan in the world, but when you put it into form, when it took physical shape, it wasn't as perfect as you envisioned. Now, old Plato, a long time ago, hundreds of years before Christ, advocated the idea. He said that reality is the ideal. It's the theory. It's the idea. It's not the thing when it takes physical shape. Well, now that idea had tremendous impact, and in fact still has tremendous impact. It was that idea that flowed like a stream, and other ideas similar to it flowed together, and it became a river and influenced men like Augustine, who laid the foundation for what would be Calvinism. The idea that once you take the form of flesh, what happens to you? You're corrupted. You're depraved. See, it's all the same thing. Well, here at the close of this first century, the idea was coming along, and it was taking two branches. These Gnostics were taking two branches. One took the branch that the Spirit is something that is absolutely separate and apart from the physical. So that what the Spirit does has no impact. Or actually the other way. What the body does, what the physical does, has no impact on the Spirit. So that would mean that you could commit fornication. Well, you do that with the body. That wouldn't affect the soul. Now, can you see how such a doctrine as that would fit right here with this idea of teaching them to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit fornication? That's exactly what it did. And then the other branch of Gnosticism said, well, since the physical is bad, and since it defiles, then the less we have to do with it, the better. And these were the guys who became hermits. Lived on the top of flagpoles. Those guys, they were called stylites. And they would make a pole 20, 30 feet high with a little square board on top. And they'd sit up there and stay up there for years. Because they're cutting off all contact with physical. Well, now, such things as that were coming, they were beginning to spring up. And by the end of this first century, those things were coming along. Those things were already being taught. There were people that were teaching those things. So most likely these Nicolaitans were associated with that. But we don't know anything more about them so far as who they're, if there was a Nicolaus or somebody like that that they followed, we really don't know about that. But in the commendation of Jesus of the church at Ephesus, he says, "You hate the works of the Nicolaitans as I do." And we'll say a little more about that when we get to the letter to the church at Pergamum. Now, the condemnation that he gives to the church at Ephesus is, "You have lost your drive. You've lost your zeal. You've lost your fervor. You have lost your first love." And so the warning is, remember what you used to be. Repent and do things like you did at first, or I will remove your lampstand. So this is a case, not that they're doing all these horrible bad things, but it's the motive. It's the energy with which they're doing it, and so on. That's the problem. You know, let's see. We're almost through. And it came to my mind, Buford, I was thinking about something different when you were talking about let him that hath an ear. What I was thinking about, that I meant to show you, one more example of that prophetic language is, do you mind if I hate to do this because I'd like to appear to be more orderly, but I sure hate to leave out something I skipped. So I'm going to go back and get what I skipped. Back in that description of the glorified Jesus, in verse 17, when Jesus laid his right hand upon John, saying, "Fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one, and I was dead," and so on. I am the first and the last. Now, that's what I wanted to show you, that one other thing about prophetic literature and where he gets that from. That's the Isaiah. So let me go to Isaiah 41. I want to show you three verses that are fairly close together here. Isaiah 41:4. Isaiah 41:4. "Who hath wrought and done it, calling the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, the first, and with the last, I am He." And then a page or two over, Isaiah 44:6. "Thus saith the Lord, the King of Israel, and His Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first, and I am the last. Besides me, there is no God." And then in chapter 48, Isaiah 48, verse 12. Hearken unto me, O Jacob and Israel, my called. I am He. I am the first. I also am the last. So, again, whether you remember that or not, whether you take note of it or not, I just want you to be exposed to how much of this language is based in the prophets there. All right, we come now to the end of this letter to the church at Ephesus. And we talked about this last time some, so we won't belabor the point. But we come to that point that Buford mentioned. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches. He that hath an ear. What do you take that to mean? And so, since most people have ears, then that's what we need to do, isn't it? Okay? I want you to look now at Ezekiel 3:27. Ezekiel 3:27. All right, so God is talking to the prophet Ezekiel, and look what he says. Ezekiel 3:27. But when I speak with thee, I will open thy mouth, and thou shalt say unto them, Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, He that heareth, let him hear. He that forbeareth, let him forbear, for they are a rebellious house. He that heareth, let him hear, is probably a similar idea. Maybe the idea that Jesus, you know, often Jesus in the Gospels used that. He that hath an ear, hear, let him hear. So here in Revelation he uses that. Seems to be probably an allusion to the language there in Ezekiel. So to the one who has an ear, listen. Listen to what the Spirit says. To the one who overcomes, I will give the right to eat of the tree of life in the paradise of God. And when I get to a verse like that, when you get to a verse like that, what we need to do is stop all of our analysis for just a moment. And in our mind's eye, move to the paradise of God and imagine being in the paradise of God, eating the tree of life. Is there a more pleasant thought than that? And we need to do that. This book is written for us to enjoy and to profit from. As it was written for the people back there to use and profit, we can also draw great profit from this book. The tree of life. So what do you think about when you read about the tree of life? Where's the tree of life first mentioned? Garden of Eden, in the paradise back there. Yes, it does. Exactly. Yes, the tree of life was in the paradise of God. Wasn't it? Yeah, it was in the paradise of God. It was in Eden. Where is this tree of life? Paradise of God. But where is it? Where is that paradise? Heaven. So, that's a really, really wonderful idea, you know, and we need to think about that. We really do, and draw comfort from that. And throughout life, we need to be thinking about that. And the older we get, the more we need to think about the tree of life. And then when I'm cut off from here, I'm going to have that tree of life. In other words, when you're thinking about leaving the world, you really ought not to be thinking so much about leaving the world as where are you going? Because when you leave this world, are you going to be lost, have nowhere to go if you're a saint, if you're a child of God? Or do you have a place to go? We have a place to go. And that comes more and more valuable as life goes along. All right. Now then, the next letter is to the church at Smyrna. So we'll go ahead and introduce that letter tonight. It won't take us long to look at these letters. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write. Okay, now here is the self-designation. These things saith the first and the last. See, there's part of his self-designation. These things saith the first and the last, who was dead and lived again. So that's who he is. The commendation, I know your tribulation. Now remember with Ephesus, he said, I know your what? I know your works. That's right. And now with Smyrna, he says, I know your tribulation. You know, we have several songs we sing. Jesus knows, Jesus knows. We have a song we sing that asks a question. Does Jesus care? And it is, we are assured, Jesus says, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And the blasphemy of them that say they are Jews and they are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. I believe this was referring to persecution and opposition on the part of Jews in a synagogue. And the irony is that here these are supposed to have been the covenant people of God, called to be righteous and called to all that. And here they are now having turned into a synagogue of Satan in their opposition to the Lord's cause. I know your tribulation and your poverty. Now the poverty, when he says, I know your poverty, obviously that is not spiritual poverty, is it? Because, yeah, Buford, what does he say? Yeah, that's material things. Because he turns around and says, you are rich. So when he says you are rich, he means spiritually you're rich. No, it was in material things. I know your poverty. Poverty. That's a thing that probably all of us have known some about, but don't know as much about it as we used to. Buford? Well, I know that one of the charges against Christians was that they were atheists because they rejected all of the false gods, including an emperor if he claimed deity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right. Idolatry is always glad to welcome another god. Just like denominations are always glad to welcome another denomination. The only exception is if there is a god that says all the other gods are false. And the only church that the denominations are not going to like is one that says all the denominations are unscriptural and without scriptural foundation. They were, idolatry found it easy to accept another god. Is that bell rung? It's time for it. Okay. All right. Well, we'll go ahead and stop here at this point, and we'll go ahead and continue that study of the letter to the church at Smyrna next time.